from the studios of Postscript Media and Canary Media.
Sindhuja Rangarajan has a degree in computer science, but she realized pretty quickly she didn't like it as much as she expected. Sindhuja did like telling stories, though, and so she went back to school for journalism.
You know, when I got my journalism degree, I realized that I have these skills, programming skills, analysis skills, the ability to just open Excel and not get lost. And so I realized that I could put them to good use.
About a decade ago, she became a data journalist. Sindhuja pores over data sets to uncover stories about systematic inequality and immigration, school rankings, microloans, diversity, and tech. She's now a senior investigative data reporter at Bloomberg. And this summer, she turned her attention to corporate climate accounting.
You know, the amount of hype as you open your browser or as you, like, go to shop, you just see all of these climate pledges or you see something as climate friendly. There's just so much hype from corporations about emissions and emission cutting. And I was like, look, I'm a data journalist. Is there anything we can do about this? And we started digging into corporate emissions.
Sindhuja linked up with Bloomberg investigative reporter Ben Elgin. Ben's written extensively about problems with carbon markets. They wanted to compare the difference in large corporate emissions when they factored in renewable energy credits. This is known as market-based accounting. And when they actually accounted for the generation mix that powers a company's operations, that's known as location-based accounting. Ben suggested they dig into data from the Carbon Disclosure Project, a nonprofit that collects and scores corporate climate pledges.
They have some of the most comprehensive data on this issue. So again, you know, analyzing that company by company, I think has never been done before.
How big was that gap?
That gap was massive. You know, we looked at around 6,000 reports in 2021. We analyzed 8,000, you know, filings across 4 years from 2017 to 2020. And we found that, you know, in 2020, 1,318 companies had a difference of 112 million metric tons CO2 between their location and their market-based emissions. So that's huge. We're talking about, you know, how much 24 million cars would emit in a year.
Intel, Pepsi, Starbucks, Procter & Gamble, thousands of the world's biggest companies rely on renewable energy credits to make sustainability claims. It's a very common and controversial tool, and there's increasing scrutiny into how these credits distort our emissions reality.
It makes it seem like there's all this progress, but it doesn't give like a accurate accounting of what's going on.
This is The Carbon Copy. I'm Stephen Lacey. This week, two conversations on the state of corporate sustainability. We'll talk with Bloomberg's Sindhuja Rangarajan about the creative math behind renewable energy credits. And we'll hear from Joel McCower of GreenBiz about what is actually making an impact in corporate sustainability and what is still holding it back. In the blink of an eye, AI has become one of the largest new sources of power demand in the U.S. So how do we serve the AI boom without building lots of new fossil gas plants? And how can we seize the opportunity to get creative about expanding grid capacity and designing data centers? This is one of the most pressing stories in energy right now. And on May 8th, Latitude Media is holding a virtual event on this topic as part of our Transition AI series. I'm going to be joined by three experts who will offer a range of views on how to address the energy needs of AI computing. And you can sign up for free by going to latitudemedia.com/events or click the link in the show notes. May 8th, Transition AI, AI and Power Demand. I'll see you there. The emissions equivalent of 24 million cars. As Sindhuja said at the top of the show, that's how big the gap is between two different kinds of corporate emissions accounting. And to understand why companies can just make 24 million cars disappear without meaningfully changing their operations, we need to break down how the two accounting methods in question work. There are three different kinds of emissions. Scope 1 emissions come from equipment and operations directly under a company's control. Then you've got Scope 3 emissions on the other end of the spectrum. Those come from suppliers and other activity outside a company's control. They're very difficult to track. And Scope 2 emissions, the ones we're talking about here, come from the energy produced to power a company's operations. And there are a couple of ways to report them.
companies can report something called as location-based emissions, which is, you know, hey, this is my office. I take some of this energy from, you know, our local grid. And the grid, on an average, has like this emission factor that we're going to use. And we're going to say, we consume so much electricity, the grid's emission factor is something. And so we're going to multiply that and we're going to calculate something called as location-based emissions.
And then there's market-based accounting. That includes long-term contracts that a company might sign with a wind, solar, or hydro project in a distant place. Even though it might not be directly powering operations, that contract directly helped put new clean energy on the grid. It's a good thing. But this accounting method also heavily relies on a magic wand called a REC. That's a renewable energy credit. It's this certificate for the environmental value of a megawatt hour of electricity from wind, solar, or water. It's often generated in some far-off place. It's a separate tradable commodity from an actual electron. And unlike those power purchase agreements, the RECs do not support new renewables. They're just a tiny revenue stream for project developers, so they are not decarbonizing the grid. But large companies have historically gobbled them up, stuffing them into their market-based accounting models, and use them as proof of how much clean energy they're buying.
When you use those market-based emissions against your goals, and then you say, you know, we've slashed our emissions by 60% or 50% or whatever it is that you claim, is it really helping the environment?
The answer, at least when it comes to RECs, is probably not. A study just published in the journal Nature Climate Change looked at 115 companies with science-based targets. These are targets modeled after the Paris Climate Accord. And researchers found that 42% of planned emissions cuts from those companies will, quote, not result in real-world mitigation because they rely on RECs. Take those credits out of the picture and poof, no ability to meet their goals. Sindhuja and Ben also wanted to quantify just how much these RECs are skewing reality, and they looked at data from thousands of companies.
So let's get into some of the specific claims that you were tracking and comparing. What were some of the big picture claims from top companies that you started to dig into?
So, you know, we looked at so many companies and, you know, for example, Procter & Gamble, you know, decided to claim that, you know, it slashed 50% of its emissions. And then when you really look at, you know, how they got to that 50% reduction, then a lot of it is using renewable energy credits. But if you calculate it without the credits, then that's like a difference of 12%. With Cisco, again, you know, emissions reductions and claims using a certain form of accounting would be 60%. But then when you actually remove the credits from the equation, then their emissions have actually gone up by 22%. Another example that comes to mind is Intel, where, you know, their emissions have actually gone up by 38%. But when you like calculate using renewable energy credits, then it only goes up by like 17%. So there's like a huge gap between when you take those credits and then when you don't take those credits. And we write about so many companies that are doing that. And some of the companies we mentioned in the story are Procter & Gamble, Cisco, Visa, Intel, Pepsi, Continental AG, and, you know, Deloitte. So, and that's just scratching the surface in terms of like the companies even doing it.
Did the gap between claims and reality surprise you?
If I had seen like more companies that were like unknown names, smaller companies, and if I had seen a different trend, I would have, you know, not been as surprised. But I think just the scale, the size, and the number of companies involved did surprise me.
So you are a data reporter. Climate sustainability is not your specific beat. As you dug into this and come out of the story, analyzing all this data, do you think differently about corporate sustainability or the claims that you, environmental claims that you hear?
Absolutely. I think, you know, the reporting process has spurred a lot of like interest personally for me to like look for more, because this is, you know, analyzing scope 2 emissions, specific, you know, instruments, but what else is out there? What else are companies doing? And I think that, you know, particularly when it comes to climate, I feel like there's so much data that's not been mined. When you read an ESG report and you see a company slashing its emissions by 15, 20, 50, 70%, like, what do you believe?
Sindhuja Rangarajan, thank you so much. A real pleasure.
It was a pleasure for me as well. Thank you so much.
We're going to take a quick break here, Afterward, we'll hear from Green Biz's Joel McCower, who's been following corporate sustainability for nearly three decades. And he says the problems go way deeper than just accounting. There is absolutely no doubt that most large corporations are thinking differently about climate change and sustainability. Even when casting those wrecks aside, nearly 40% of renewable energy added to the U.S. grid since 2014 came from corporate power purchase agreements. That's according to the Clean Energy Buyers Association. Some companies, like Stripe and Microsoft, are setting negative emissions targets and investing meaningful sums of money in early carbon removal projects. And then you've got Google, which is pioneering renewable energy procurement on an hourly basis in an attempt to match 100% renewables on the grid for its operations. Meanwhile, shareholder pressures are pushing boardrooms to adopt ESG strategies, and extreme weather risk is forcing companies to evaluate their logistics. A lot is happening.
And, you know, that's the good news. The bad news is that it's still not happening at the scale, scope, and speed that we need.
Joel McCower has been following this space for three decades. He's someone that I've also followed closely to get a read on how corporate sustainability is playing out. He's the chairman and co-founder of the Green Biz Group, and I caught up with him at Green Biz's Verge conference recently. I wanted to get his read on what all this activity adds up to, because it certainly feels different, but is it actually different? Joel doesn't think we're at a stage of radical transformation yet.
Well, I think it is important, but I also think it's still relatively few and far between that, you know, yes, Microsoft, yes, Amazon, yes, Walmart, you know, yes, you know, a handful of other companies, mostly in the tech field, but it's the same old companies, Stephen. It's the same ones we talk about. But in the rest of the corporate world, it's still radical incrementalism, you know, just a lot of small ball kinds of things that companies are doing that you know, are necessary but highly insufficient and do not roll up to the magnitude of the moment. And that's the challenge, is that, yes, they're, you know, and look, I've been in this field for over 30 years, and every year, certainly every few years, you can say there's some new things, you know, circular economy, ESG, and sustainability, carbon removal, just on and on and on. And yet, so many of these events and so many of these conversations is February 2nd. It's Groundhog Day all over again. And so that's the challenge. That's the frustrating part. I'm most days a glass half full kind of guy, but frankly, I think the glass is just way too small.
Mm. Why is that? What are the forces inside companies that are contributing to that incrementalism?
In a word, change. You know, change, you know, we all love the noun, but hate the verb. You know, we like the idea of change. We need to change, you know, things need to change. We need to change the system. We need to change the way the system. Changing itself, the verb, is actually hard to do, really hard to do. And there's a lot of resistance to that. And inside companies, you know, it used to be back, you know, in the day, it was like, get CEO buy-in, you know, and CEO say, I'm in. We need to do this stuff. And the young recruits, they want this stuff. It's that big, fat, impenetrable wad of resistance called middle management that's often thwarted. They're really adept at thwarting change. And so, you know, and some of that's, you know, C-suite led too. They're making these commitments, but they're not really equipping, you know, the people to and supporting them to make the kinds of changes they need to make. But I think an even bigger issue is that it's still, when it all even happens, it's still not enough. And, you know, we really need to transform our economy. We need to transform how we make and do things. We need to transform the business models. We need to transform the consumption habits. You know, we need to change everything. And that's an extraordinarily exciting opportunity. But it means that that everybody's in a threatened incumbent. And so there's, you know, and threatened incumbents are known to throw up huge barriers and walls, and they've got lobbyists and all kinds of things. That, to me, is the biggest obstacle. It's so far just seen as a mandatory requirement, disclosure, you know, things that about change. And change, the only thing worse than having to change is having to be forced to change. And so I'm sorry, I'll just keep using the change word, but that's really where it comes down to.
You know, it's so interesting, your take, because if someone had asked me how different is this world, I would probably give them a much more optimistic answer than you you gave. And but obviously, I would probably give the examples of the biggest corporates and the folks that have been at the leading edge of this for a while. And so what you're saying is that there is this whole range of, you know, mid-sized companies that haven't even really grappled with this, or maybe they're just starting to. And can you be more specific? Like when they're not doing things, what are they? Are they just not setting targets? Are they not? Are they not hiring the right people? Like, what is causing that inertia inside this broad range of companies that still are not grappling with sustainability?
Well, there's not a question you can ask me of that sort of big picture nature where the answer doesn't begin. It depends, and it depends a lot on. You know, again, there's a political piece. There's we're doing great. Our customers love our products. No one's asking for us to do anything things more sustainably. We're privately held, so we don't have any investors or SEC reporting requirements. The media, the activists, no one's beating down the door saying you must change. And so if you're doing well, and no one's forcing you to do it, you know, why do it? Because it can be disruptive, and it can be disruptive in a really good way. So I just think there's just a lot of, a lot of resistance to change if you don't have to. And a lot of companies don't yet feel you need to do this. And by the way, I am an extremely optimistic person. I mean, being in sustainability is an inherently optimistic profession. We wake up every day thinking about solutions, about moonshots or earth shots now, and thinking about how do we transform things. So I don't mean to not be optimistic. We have to be, because the alternative is just too damn depressing. But yeah, I'm also realistic with what's going on out there. I'm not, there are people who say, yeah, sustainable business and everything's changing and the world's going to be better, and hope maybe. But there's just so much that's not happening yet the way it needs to happen. We are not on path to meet the climate, the Paris goals. We're not on path to meet the sustainable development goals. We're not on the path as a nation in this country, United States, to meet even, basic goals, or even in states that have set renewables targets or carbon reduction targets. And so we've got a lot of work to do. You can look at that as, oh my God, it's depressing, or as an amazing opportunity. I obviously prefer the latter.
Let's talk about STICs. So there has been a major move internationally to get securities regulators to force public companies to disclose climate risk. That has played out at the Securities and Exchange Commission here in the U.S., and we're starting to see rules come together on disclosing climate risk. How important do you think that is?
I think it's important. I don't think it's necessarily the game changer that a lot of people, I think, profess it to be. Look, you need a base. You need some compliance, and the definition of compliance is that if it was any less, it would be illegal. And so you need to set that minimum expectation. But it's a floor. It's not really, the minimum expectation isn't going to, again, get us where we need to be going. So I think it's great. I also think it's going to, in its practice, in the compliance of with whatever the SEC ultimately comes back with, is going to be with sufficient, not necessarily loopholes, but the ability to meet the requirements with a bunch of vague language that doesn't really get to what we were hoping it would get to in terms of companies really assessing their risks and starting to, first of all, disclose them, and then ultimately hopefully dealing with them. I mean, when I talk about give presentations about all of this stuff, and people say, what's the business case? As if there's a business case for destroying the planet. And I say, well, there's an old answer and a new answer. The old answer is, about reducing costs, increasing revenue, attracting talent, being a preferred supplier, obviously reputational stuff, blah, blah. And that's not untrue, but really it boils down to one word: risk. Financial risk, reputational risk, right to operate risk, transitional risk, technology risk, regulatory risk. There's lots of different flavors. And I think that making the SEC is trying to pull, and a lot of the and its counterparts around the world is trying to pull out that risk so that everybody can see it, and it's visible, and for investors, for employees, for customers, whoever it is, neighbors. I don't have great hopes that the regulations are actually going to accomplish that. I think there's a lot more, you know, in the task force for climate-related financial disclosures and then now the task force for nature-related financial disclosures, that a lot of those things, which will be enforced through contracts, supplier relationships, buyer-seller relationships, will have more clout, bigger sticks than and then, of course, the carrots of the opportunities and the ability to either retain business or gain new business, I think, will, or attract talent, or all those things that is part of my old answer, which are still relevant. So I think, you know, the risk piece of this is fascinating.
So the risks and impacts are worsening, but the on the positive side, the technologies and solutions we have are getting a lot better. And so, you know, over the past 30, I mean, the amount of solutions we have at hand compared to when you started in this field 30 years ago are just wildly different.
Yeah, and that's the happy story here. And it certainly is the story here at Verge. And it's not just the so-called green and clean or climate technologies, you know, like EV and solar and wind and or even, you know, a lot of it's just, you know, it's AI and robotics and optical scanning and synthetic biology you know, machine learning and a whole bunch of other technologies that are going to allow us, enable us to track and, you know, gain visibility into supply chains, allow us to do reshore or localize manufacturing at a small scale instead of shipping things across oceans, allow us to build materials that used to come from oil or in some cases, I'm working with a company that's making an alternative to palm oil that's chemically identical, but it comes in a factory and not from a field. And when you look at the destruction of, you know, habitat and rainforest and all that in growing time, I mean, those are revolutionary things. And the other piece, the last piece of not last, but one other piece is just the impact on people, the opportunities that these technologies can bring. We're seeing, you know, companies lean into their smallholder farmers in remote parts of the world and giving them with just not even a smartphone, but just a phone, where they can now tap into weather and market conditions and buy and sell things and report things and become a much more engaged and hopefully resilient supplier to these big corporate supply chains, improve standards of living. I mean, look, if we're not improving lives and, you know, in moving the needle on the biggest environmental challenges we have, this is not sustainability. It's just, you know, it's just helping business, you know, make more money. And we have to be improving lives here. And I think that's one of the things that the good news is, well, the bad news is we're not really talking about that as much. And the good news is we have now all the tools and technologies we need to make those things happen.
Joel McCower, thanks so much.
It's my pleasure, Stephen. Thank you.
That is it for the show. The Carbon Copy is a co-production of Postscript Media and Canary Media. Go to canarymedia.com for show notes, back episodes, lots of other good journalism from Canary Media's reporters who you hear on this show. You can also sign up for our newsletter at postscriptmedia.com. We've got a ton of shows constantly churning out. I mean, we're trying to cover every element of the climate story, and so you'll get updates on what we're releasing. And hope you can join us because we've got some live shows coming up as well with our other co-hosts. This episode was produced by me and Alexandria Herr. Sean Marquan is our engineer. Original music came from Echo Finch and Blue Dot Sessions. Postscript Media is supported by Prelude Ventures. Prelude is a venture capital firm. It partners with entrepreneurs to address climate change across advanced energy, food and agriculture, transportation and logistics, advanced materials and manufacturing, and advanced computing. Go ahead and give us a rating and review on Apple or Spotify. You know, we ask it every single time, but there's a reason for that because it's really helpful. And thanks for spreading awareness about the show. And if you've got ideas for the show, then hit us up on social media, or you can send us an email to hello@postscriptaudio.com. I'm Stephen Lacey. This is The Carbon Copy. We'll catch you next week.